Welcome to the Global Governance Podcast, where we explore the future of governance. Each episode will look at a different global issue and how governance plays a key role in its solution. From climate change to gender equality, from corruption to peace and security, we invite experts to explore a thought-provoking game of what if and why not, positing a world in much closer international cooperation. And now your host, Augusto López Claros. Enjoy.
The year 2020 marked a very important milestone for the United Nations, the 75th anniversary of the adoption of the UN Charter in 1945. Overshadowed in some ways by the catastrophic effects of the global pandemic, this momentous occasion served as a stark reminder of the urgent need for increased international cooperation. Against the background of multiple global challenges confronting us all, government, civil society, the business community, international multilateral organizations such as missions, indeed, the entire human family. Today, we will explore some of the questions to which the UN anniversary has given heightened prominence with a very special guest, Undersecretary General at the United Nations, Fabrizio Hochschild. Fabrizio started a long and distinguished career at the UN in 1988 and has served the organization in multiple roles and in multiple locations, including Sudan, Jerusalem, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Geneva, New York, Timor-Leste, Serbia, and the United Republic of Tanzania. He thus brings to his current role a wealth of experience and insight based on over three decades of operational work, straddling some of the most important areas of UN work. Fabrizio, you are most welcome today. It is an honor to have this podcast with you. In April of 2019, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres appointed you as his special advisor on the preparations for the commemoration of the 75th anniversary of the United Nations at the Undersecretary General level. You spearheaded the effort to reach out to civil society and other stakeholders to learn about the kind of UN that we need to confront the key challenges of the 21st century. Can you please share with us what were the main insights from that fascinating exercise?
Well, thank you very much. And let me say what a pleasure it is to be with you. As you indicated, the Secretary General did not want to mark the 75th anniversary with the normal celebratory events and by telling people about our achievements, but on the contrary, wanted a global listening tour to take a sort of global pulse check, a global reality check of what the world hoped for and where the world feared we were heading. What we found was remarkable unity, and we heard from well over a million people in all 195 states. We had remarkable unity when it comes to hopes and fears for the future. In the immediate aftermath of COVID, the primary goal for recovery was improved access to healthcare and other basic services like education, water, and sanitation. The second priority, perhaps more surprisingly, was a call for much greater solidarity. COVID really highlighted the inequalities the world was already suffering from and that the pandemic has exacerbated. So people called for better support to the hardest hit communities and the hardest hit countries and an adjustment of our economic model in order to make it more inclusive. In terms of longer term priorities, there was really a focus on climate change, and that was universal. The biggest concern for the future everywhere and across generations and income groups is the damage we're doing to our environment and to our climate. There were also concerns around and calls to do more about protracted conflict in all its forms, including growing political violence, growing violence from organized criminal groups, to do more about corruption, to do more about poverty. Strikingly, everybody wants to see more international cooperation, more multilateralism to further these goals. but they also want to see multilateralism and international cooperation that's more inclusive of today's stakeholders. Those were the main findings.
Thank you. Very interesting. Very interesting. We will come back to some of the issues that you covered in a couple of minutes. But in the meantime, let's step back a little bit and let's review a bit of the history of the United Nations over the past 75 years. What would you consider to be its three most important achievements? What can we be proud of as we look at the record of the last 75 years? And if you allow me, can I also ask you about, you know, some of its failures or disappointments, those areas in which perhaps the UN did not meet the high expectations and very noble principles that were embedded in the UN Charter in 1945?
I think its largest achievement, and something that today we take for granted, but that our grandparents and the founders of the UN were very concerned with, was the avoidance of superpower confrontation, the avoidance of another world war. In human history, the world has never lived so long without an armed confrontation between the superpowers. And the fact that the majority of people on Earth have been able to grow up in peace in our generation and the one before it, and with ever more progress, I think much of it is a contribution of the United Nations. I think we've also made massive progress on normative frameworks for upholding human rights and human dignity in a manner that had never happened with the same intensity before in history. I think in terms of conflict, we've done a great deal. Both through peacekeeping, we've saved tens of thousands of lives, and through humanitarian aid. Today, WFP feeds close to 100 million people every single day. And finally, we have this unique framework for sustainable development, which is the first ever global framework which on how to guide our economies, on how to guide our development and social actions for the greater good of all humanity, including succeeding generations. That has never existed, and that's particularly crucial as a roadmap for post-COVID recovery. But there have been failings, as you indicated. I think the worst ones which happened during my 30-year career and that immediately come to mind and still make me feel anxiety and shame are some of the atrocities where the UN failed to speak up or failed to act. The silence of the UN and the inaction of large parts of the UN, despite some of the heroic actions of those on the ground in light of the 1994 Rwanda genocide. The inaction of the UN, most of the UN at the time of the Srebrenica massacres in 1995, are muted speaking out against the backdrop of the massacres of civilians in northern Sri Lanka in 2009. But I think some of the worst and most shameful chapters were there, those where the UN itself was unwittingly or wittingly engaged in committing harm. And there I'm thinking of the cholera outbreak that we contributed to, obviously without wanting to, in Haiti in 2010. And then the most awful cases of sexual exploitation and abuse that we hear periodically about in recent years. But I do think the UN has tried very hard to both to make itself accountable for where inaction has contributed or silence has contributed, and to learn from those failings. But of course, those are very dark and will always remain dark chapters in our history. But I do believe we have done our utmost to try and make sure we do better in future after each of those dark chapters.
Thank you, Fabrizio, for giving us that historical perspective and for speaking with some candor about some of the disappointments or the sort of the failures. And also, thank you for emphasizing that perhaps the UN has learned from those failures and has internalized the appropriate lessons so that some of these things will not happen again in the future. Beyond the wishes and aspirations of we the peoples, as the Charter says, can we talk briefly about the sorts of reforms that are needed within the UN system to empower the organization to play a more central role in the process of finding solutions to some of the very intractable problems that we face today? You already mentioned climate change. There is the sort of ongoing eternal issue of nuclear proliferation. As you well know, income disparities, lack of opportunity for broad segments of the world's population, the persistence of poverty, malnutrition, and so on, these are very much on the forefront of the kind of problems that we face for which we need to find urgent solutions. And in your answer, if I could ask you to make a distinction between sort of what reforms would be desirable, abstracting ourselves a little bit from the political constraints, from the inertia and sometimes indifference on the part of some of the UN shareholders, and then if you could contrast that with what is in fact politically feasible over the next decade in terms of reforms.
This is a complex question because I think we have to acknowledge that no amount of institutional reform can compensate for where there's a lack of political will. So in some of the areas you mentioned, like dealing with eradicating extreme poverty, reducing inequalities, coping, managing, reversing climate change and the destruction of the environment, we have the solutions. They're known. They've been spelt out through the Sustainable Development Goals. They've been spelt out through the Paris Climate Accord. They've been elaborated in numerous policy instruments and guidance. The Secretary General has spent the last year advocating very strongly for very concrete measures in post-COVID recovery to help those hardest hit and to make the recovery more sustainable. So it's really not less a question of reform than of political will. I think that has to be said up front. Second, when it comes to institutional reform in the UN, the area that inevitably draws the greatest focus is reform to the Security Council. And there are a lot of concerns that the Security Council is not functioning optimally. And if there's one tragic illustration of that, it's the ongoing war in Syria, which has caused more suffering more death and suffering than any other conflict in decades. And the inability of the Security Council to come to terms with that, I think, is an illustration for many people across the world of what they see as the dysfunctionality of the United Nations. But having said that, many brilliant heads have tried to find a viable formula for Security Council reform over the past decades and have yet to come up with a formula that would both secure more representativeness and be politically viable. So I have to say Security Council reform is seen as very important. It's also seen to be something that's likely to remain evasive for some time. I think the big challenge that is perhaps more realistic and as essential is to make other parts of the UN more inclusive, to bring in more civil society, more youth voices, more business voices, more voices of cities and local authorities, more voices from regional organizations into the deliberations of the UN. And I think there's action already happening on that. I think it's working relatively well in some parts of the UN, and I think there's great potential to make it work very well in other parts of the UN. And I'm sure the Secretary General, as part of the follow-up of the UN 75 exercise, will be making realistic and concrete, but also ambitious proposals in that regard to member states in summer this year.
I found very encouraging what you said at the outset of this podcast when you were commenting on the response from the 1 million people that you consulted with last year, and some of the issues that were identified as being vital, the question of solidarity, adjustments to the economic model, the question of climate change, poverty, and so on, and I'm sure that these concerns were, of course, heightened by the pandemic, as I think you noted. Now, related to that, my question is, has COVID-19 precipitated a debate within the UN shareholders, right? In other words, governments, not civil society, not young people and others out there who responded to your survey, to this consultation that you held in 2020, but rather, you know, the official sector, the civil servants, the governments who send their representatives to the Security Council, to the General Assembly, have they begun to think about, the kinds of reforms that should be implemented to our environmental, social, economic systems, in light of what we have gone through in 2020, which, as you know, is unprecedented, the kind of economic crisis that we have seen that has devastated the global economy has no precedent. You have to go back to, the early 1930s to see anything that comes close to it.
I think there is a lot of reflection among member states about both the importance of international cooperation, multilateralism, and the UN in particular, and how it can be renewed, reinvigorated, and reimagined to better address 21st century challenges, both those existing and those emerging. I think that is exemplified by the UN 75 Declaration, which, frankly, a year or so ago, many of us thought, given current rivalries and fragmentation between states, would not be possible. And yet, member states came together and identified 12 priorities for the UN, both in terms of substance and in terms of institutional renewal. So I think that shows that there really is an understanding that we cannot go back to the status quo ante, that there really is a need for renewal and reinvigoration. And they identified the 12 specific areas where they see that as necessary. And they've asked the Secretary General to come back with suggestions on how that should be done. Now, of course, while everybody sees the need for change and renewal, I think if you go to individual member states, you'll hear very different things about what that specific change should be, what that specific renewal should be. But I really hope that COVID, the reminder of COVID, the reminder that multilateralism is not some abstract intellectual concept, but where it works, lives are saved, and where it doesn't work, lives are lost. And I hope that that global COVID-induced reality check will allow the minds to focus not on perpetuating differences and just focusing on delineating why one disagrees with this other regional bloc, but on finding common ground. And I think there are some encouraging signs that there will be a very earnest effort building on the UN 75 Declaration to find common ground for the sort of renewal, reimagining that is so urgently required.
That's very encouraging, Fabrizio. I'm very happy to hear that coming from you, who obviously have participated from the inside on many of these debates and questions. I often think about some of the more important achievements in international cooperation in the 20th century, and they always came in the wake of calamity and suffering and distress and collapse. The League of Nations after World War One, the United Nations itself, and perhaps a bit later the European Union against the background of World War II and so on. So I'm not surprised that perhaps COVID-19, with the great suffering and destruction that it has brought to the world, is precipitating this kind of debate, and that's encouraging. Although one would wish that one wouldn't have to wait for a debilitating crisis, create incentives for our leaders to begin to think about, the need for enhanced international cooperation. Let me step back a little bit and let me ask another sort of restate a question which I posed before, but from a different angle. When Grenville Clark and his partner and colleague at Harvard, Louis Son, wrote that magnificent treatise, World Peace Through World Law, in the 1950s, outlining an ambitious set of reforms to the UN Charter, which in their view were necessary to actually empower the UN to deliver on its peace and security mandates, their proposals fell on deaf ears. By then, by the late 50s, we were in the middle of the Cold War, and had already entered a period of the arms race, we're not going to retrace the history of the 60s, 70s, and 80s here. But my question to you is, against the background of what has happened in 2020, with COVID-19, against the background of what we know is likely to happen in coming years as a result of an acceleration of climate change, and we already see a number of signs of that, which are really very disturbing, is the world today more ready for something like the Clark prescriptions than it was in the 1950s and 60s? Or is it going to take yet another calamity like COVID-19, maybe multiplied by 5 or 10 in coming years, to finally move us into the kinds of reforms that are necessary to effectively deal with climate change, not the kind of tinkering at the edges that we seem to be doing now?
I think that's the critical question of our time, and we'll only really know the answer 5 years from now. Institutional renewal has always happened against the backdrop of crises. The League of Nations, a failed, if worthy, attempt at something like the United Nations, was born from the Versailles Treaty after the First World War. And incidentally, some of the international mechanisms created then persist to this day. The International Labour Organization was born out of the same crisis and has done massive amounts over the past 100 years to further the interests of workers in a cooperative mechanism with employers. So crisis does give birth to improvement. The United Nations was born of the Second World War. And even if it's in need of another renewal, I think we can acknowledge that some of the progress we've made over the past decades is owing to the foresight of its founders, born out of the suffering. I think there is huge hope that the same sort of renewal will happen out of COVID. And I think there are very real possibilities in that sense. So that we have a juxtaposition of of an appetite across the globe, which was very clear from our survey, for a more effective United Nations, for intensified international cooperation, in particular, but not exclusively, to tackle climate change. But at the same time, the political differences, rivalries, and friction that make progress in an international forum so difficult still remain, and in some cases have been exacerbated by COVID. So the big question is, when we're looking back at where we were today, 5 years from now or 10 years from now, will 2021 be remembered as a turning point where humanity finally came together to raise their level of ambition, to commit to take measures that would create a better world for succeeding generations, as our founders did after the terrible suffering of the Second World War? Or will they forego this chance and get lost in isolationism, rivalries, competition, and short-term parochial interests, with a loss of consideration for the generations that come after us and global public goods? I think we see signs of both, but you know, the outcome is not predetermined, and I think it depends on all of us also within our relative respective areas of influence to fight for the sort of outcome that we would like to see, to fight with the sort of outcome that better safeguards global public goods, in particular the environment and climate, but also other global public goods like health, like inequality, etc. And I think that in trying to advocate and push and come up with ideas and work in that direction, we will find no lack of allies, in particular among the younger generations. But I also think change happens in a different way from the times you're alluding to. I mean, the UN came into being, and the suggestions you alluded to all came from a few bright minds, great leaders, men, a few men sitting in a room. I think today reform and change happens more through social movements on the street. And we've seen many examples of that, including climate activism. And I think the UN needs to be much better connected to that sort of sentiment and that sort of those sorts of movements. And that was also part of the UN 75 access to that you exercise, to have much better connection with global sentiment among the people most affected by some of the deficits in international cooperation.
Thank you, Fabrizio. That was very well said. And as you were speaking, I was reminded of the fact that in thinking about some of the most important initiatives of international cooperation in the last couple of decades, like the establishment of the International Criminal Court, like the treaty to the elimination of nuclear weapons, like the Paris Agreement on climate change, all of these would have been impossible without the strong support of civil society and social movements and young people and others, you know, who feel that they needed to step in because of the inaction of governments. Now, one possible reform which has been discussed in recent years, and I'm thinking of Richard Falk's article in Foreign Affairs some 20 years ago with the provocative title Toward a World, a Global Parliament, is the establishment of a United Nations World Parliamentary Assembly, a second chamber that could be created within the UN system with members initially drawn from the member country legislatures, following a bit on the model established by the European Parliamentary Assembly, which evolved from 1958 to the current European Parliament. And that this could be done as a means of strengthening the democratic legitimacy of the United Nations. Professor Falk, in his piece, argued that this body could be initially given an advisory role and be a preparatory step towards eventually giving the General Assembly a greater say on matters of peace and security and other questions of global importance. Do you see this as a potentially useful initiative, especially given that it would not require amending the UN Charter, which of course is a very forbidden step?
I think the suggestion points towards a very real challenge the UN has, and that also came out very strongly in our global consultations during last year. And that is the sense that as worthy as the cause of the UN is, as desirable as it, as most people feel it is for the UN to grow in relevance and importance, there's also a sense that the UN is rather disconnected, slightly out of touch, and remote. And of course, that's not so surprising. I mean, the UN works with diplomatic representatives of member states, and much of what is done silently in the manner in which diplomats work and achieve results, which is often discreet. So there is this sense that the our deliberations, our little blue bubble here on the banks of the East River is not well connected to the rest of the world. And I have to say, if one serves in the field, as I have done and many UN colleagues have done, and then comes to headquarters and sort of from a mindset of dealing with the realities in our field operations is then faced with some of the deliberations here, it can often seem very remote, very abstract, and a little out of touch. And in that sense, having some representation here that would feel direct accountability to the people who elected them from all over the world would seem like a contributing solution. But having said that, you know, we have to ask ourselves, what is the nature of the UN and would member states be ready to go in that direction? And there, I think, the answer is probably not. In the case of the European Union, there was a very conscious decision by member states that became part of it to give up a part of their national sovereignty to a supranational union. And that is also exemplified through the parliament. So the parliament has real powers that were ceded to it by member states. In the case of the UN, there's no question of states ceding sovereignty to a supranational body. That's out of the question, and that would, you know, lead to a very negative reaction by many of our members. The UN is there for cooperation, not for ceding sovereignty, in some sense, by international cooperation to strengthen national sovereignty. So in that sense, I think there would be hesitancy to have anybody with directly elected members as opposed to diplomatic representatives who, more as well as building bridges, are there to much more directly uphold the national interests of their states. But I do think there's room to make the UN more inclusive. I do think the fact that a parliamentary assembly, as interesting as the idea is, not being very realistic, I do think we have to work very hard at finding other ways to make people feel better represented by the UN, to make people feel more part of the UN. And I think there have been many ways over the years that that's been done. I think if you just look at the Committee on the Status of Women, which brings in not only government representatives, but representatives of civil society organizations from all over the world, I think there's a real sense in that body where women feel this is ours. And I think we need to learn from that and similar bodies to find ways to become more representative and to address the underlying problem that proposal is based on and that was reaffirmed in the consultations we undertook. So I think we need new thinking. And again, I'm sure that the Secretary General's UN 75 report, the common agenda, as it'll be called, will have very concrete ideas in that respect.
I think you are right in saying that perhaps at this particular moment in history, even against the background of COVID-19, perhaps the UN membership is not yet ready for the kind of abdication of national sovereignty that the European states, in fact, were made ready for in the 1950s, as a result of the calamities of World War II and what that said about the kind of governance system that they had in place, leading up to that conflict. Fabrizio, as an economist, one source of concern to me is the huge gap between the unresolved global problems that we face, which have come up in the context of this conversation, perhaps the most important of which is mitigating climate change, on the one hand, and the very scarce, very humble financial resources which are made available to the UN system by its members. I will not mention figures. I'm sure you're intimately familiar with them. Can we talk about the United Nations we want in 2045, its 100th anniversary, without confronting head-on the need to put the finances of the UN on a more solid foundation, especially given that none of the global problems that we currently face can be resolved outside of a framework of strengthened international cooperation, and the UN, for all its limitations, seems to be the best vehicle to undertake these processes.
I think finance is key, and even as a non-economist, all of us are very, very aware of that. I think that debate, one has to say at the outset that the biggest and most important deficits are with regard to the funding needed, for example, for the COVAX initiative, the funding needed to pay for climate adjustment, the funding needed to eradicate extreme poverty and overcome inequalities, the funding needed to address the massive increase in humanitarian needs. Those are the most urgent funding needs when it comes to the United Nations. But of course, the Secretariat and the core bodies of the UN that go about trying to make that work happen have to have some degree of predictability and some degree of security, and not constantly have to worry about where the money is going to come to pay next month's salaries. And that insecurity and the need to focus on that takes up a lot of time and a lot of effort. There's not one senior official at the UN that doesn't spend a significant amount of time and worry on the insecurity of our financial situation. And of course, that time and worry is time and worry that should instead be spent on solving the real problems for which we are employed. So I think we need to find a more stable, secure financial basis, which at the same time shouldn't make us complacent. I mean, we should be judged by our results, but we need that security to achieve those results. And again, I believe that there are many there are many options under discussion, and I'm sure that the Secretary General is one of the things highlighted in the UN 75 declaration, and one of the areas where the Secretary General will be coming back to member states with a series of proposals of how we could put on more secure footing, which would allow us in turn to do our jobs better.
Fabrizio, let me finish with one slightly provocative question, and by giving you an opportunity as well to have the last few words in this very interesting, very insightful podcast, for which I'm very, very grateful that you made the time available. And I will go back to the survey that you undertook in 2020 of basically the kind of UN that people would like to have in coming years. Let's jump ahead and let's place ourselves in 2030, and let's assume that you have to describe to these 1 million people who provided you feedback in 2020 what the UN has achieved in the meantime over that 10-year period from 2020 to 2030. What, in your view, are some of the messages that you would like to be in a position to deliver then?
I'd like to be able to say, we heard you. We have grown more inclusive. Youth, civil society, business, local leaders are better represented in our deliberations through all these means. I'd like to be able to say that not least thanks to that, we've been able to focus much better on maintaining and improving global public goods. We've made very significant progress with the help of a much broader involvement of youth and civil society on reducing the threat of climate change, on enhancing species diversity, and on containing pollution. I'd like to be able to say that we've also made important strides forward on reducing inequality by ensuring that our economic models are not just more sustainable, but also more inclusive of those who threaten to be left furthest behind. And I'd also like to be able to say that thanks to that growth in inclusiveness and the identification of common purposes, we've also reduced and prevented conflict, both in its manifestations of internal conflict and conflict between states, but also in terms of political violence and violence against women. And I doubt the world will be perfect by 2030. But I think to achieve progress in those areas is very much within the reach of the possible. And I think a determined effort and a refocus on our common interests, despite the differences, in the same way that the founders of the UN identified common interests, despite their very real and major differences, in a manner that kept most of us safe and with progress for 70 years, I believe that is possible. And now is the moment.
Thank you, Fabrizio, for presenting a positive, compelling vision of where we would like the United Nations to be by 2030. It is evident that there is a great deal at stake in this debate. We at the Global Governance Forum would suggest that the next decade will be full of possibilities to give the United Nations a more central role and the formulation of solutions to some of the many intractable problems we face today. We think that the moral framework defined by the United Nations Charter needs to be applied with increasing fidelity as we move to a world in which more of the 193 UN members endeavor to show respect for international law, uphold fundamental human rights, and adhere to the letter and the spirit of its principles. As we do this, we will ensure that the machinery of international politics and power is increasingly directed towards cooperation and unity. Your comments today have given us hope that if we do this, we will open up unparalleled prospects for progress.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Global Governance Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and family. To learn more, please visit globalgovernanceforum.org and join the conversation.